Welcome to episode 1332 of the 1010 Thrive podcast, brought to you by 1010 Thrive Ministries. 1010 Thrive, 10 minutes a day based on 10 guidelines for abundant living. There is a moment in every parent's life when they realize their child has become their God. It is not a theological realization. It arrives as a felt truth, usually in a moment of panic or decision-making. A mother lies awake at 3 a.m., mind-spinning with what-ifs about her teenager. A father turns down a job opportunity because it would require moving his family away from a particular school or community. A couple sacrifices their marriage to preserve their children's comfort. These are not stories of parents loving too much. These are stories of love without limits, love that has become ultimate, that has assumed the place only God can safely hold. Or consider the executive whose identity is entirely bound up in professional success. The slightest criticism of his work feels like a personal annihilation. He cannot rest because rest feels like irrelevance. His career is not just what he does. It has become who he is. Or the woman whose beauty has become the lens through which she reads all worth, hers and everyone else's. Aging feels like dying. A wrinkle is a betrayal. She loves her appearance, but that love has no limits, no ballast, no larger context. These are not stories of loving bad things. These are stories of loving good things. Family, achievement, beauty, security, success, in the wrong way, with ultimate devotion, without reserve. This is the disease the first commandment addresses. Not the love of created things, but the love of created things as if they were God.
I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me.
Notice how it begins. God does not start with prohibition. God starts with self-identification and with action. I am the Lord your God. I brought you out. God reminds the people of who he is and what he has done. Only then comes the commandment. You shall have no other gods. The structure is important. The prohibition makes sense only in light of the relationship. God is saying, I am the one who has proven myself faithful to you. I am the one who freed you. I am the one who can be trusted with your ultimate allegiance. In light of that reality, the commandment is not oppressive. It is an invitation to loyalty, to give ultimate devotion to the one who has demonstrated ultimate faithfulness. But here is the subtle part. You shall have no other gods before me does not mean you cannot have other attachments. It does not mean you cannot love your children, pursue meaningful work, cultivate beauty, or build wealth. It means these things cannot have primacy. They cannot be ultimate. They cannot occupy the place reserved for God alone. The Hebrew phrase, before me, carries the sense of in preference to me, or in my place. It is not about the existence of other loves. It is about the hierarchy of love. It is about what comes first. What is ultimate? What is non-negotiable? What you would die for, rather than abandon. To understand what this commandment is really protecting, we need to look at two stories from Scripture, separated by nearly 2,000 years, yet speaking to the same fundamental temptation. In Genesis 22, God calls Abraham to do something that seems to violate everything we know about God's character.
Abraham.
Elohim. Here I am.
Abraham, my servant, take your son, your only son whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain I will show you.
Stop here. Did you get that? God is asking Abraham to sacrifice his son, the son of promise, through whom all God's covenants with Abraham were supposed to be fulfilled. Now, here is something crucial to notice. The text says God tested Abraham, not tempted. That word carries the suggestion that God was trying to make Abraham sin. Tested. The Hebrew word nisa means to prove, to try, to examine. God was testing the nature of Abraham's faith. What was God testing? Not whether Abraham loved Isaac. Abraham clearly loved Isaac. The text emphasizes it. Your only son, whom you love. What God was testing was whether Abraham's love of Isaac had become ultimate. Whether Abraham loved Isaac more than he loved God. Whether Abraham would cling to the good thing, his beloved son, even if it meant disobeying the God who gave him that son in the first place. And Abraham's response is extraordinary.
Early the next morning, Abraham got up and saddled his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. When he reached the place God had told him about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then he reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son.
Abraham was willing to obey God, even though it meant losing the thing most precious to him. He was willing to surrender Isaac, not because he did not love him, but because his ultimate allegiance was not to Isaac. It was to God. And in that moment of willingness to let go, Abraham discovered something. He did not have to let go. God stopped his hand.
Abraham, stop! Do not lay a hand on the boy. Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God because you have not withheld from me, your son, your only son.
Notice, now I know that you fear God because you have not withheld from me, your son. The test was not about whether Abraham would sacrifice Isaac. The test was about whether Abraham would withhold nothing from God, whether there was any good thing he would cling to rather than trust God. And Abraham passed the test. Not by losing Isaac, by proving that Isaac, as precious as he was not ultimate. God was ultimate. In Mark 10, Jesus encounters a man who has kept all the commandments since childhood. Jesus looked at him and loved him.
One thing you lack. Go, sell everything you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come, follow me.
At this, the man's face fell. He went away sad, because he had great wealth.
Jesus does not command poverty as the price of discipleship. He commands the man to prove that God is ultimate by being willing to lose wealth. Jesus asks, what would make obedience feel like loss? What have you made ultimate? The man's sadness reveals everything. He had followed the commandments, but he had not kept the first commandment. He had given ultimate allegiance to his wealth. Do you see the parallel? Abraham faces the loss of his son. The rich young ruler faces the loss of his wealth. Different circumstances, same test. What would make obedience feel like loss? Here is the diagnostic insight. The problem is not what we love. The problem is what we cannot live without. Abraham loved Isaac intensely. But he could imagine living without Isaac if God required it. The rich young ruler could not imagine living without his wealth. God is not asking us to stop loving good things. But God is asking, are you willing to let me be ultimate? Are you willing to hold all good things lightly, to receive them with gratitude, but to hold them open-handed? Good things become God's when they determine our identity. You are not just a parent. You are a parent to the exclusion of everything else. Without this role, you are nothing. Good things become God's when they determine our security. Your child becomes the thing you cannot lose. Your wealth becomes what keeps you safe. Your reputation becomes your protection. Good things become God's when they become non-negotiable. There are things we cannot imagine giving up. We demand them as our right rather than receive them as gifts. Why is this the first commandment? Because idolatry is the root of all other sin. When something other than God is ultimate, you will inevitably sin protecting that ultimacy. If your child is ultimate, you will lie for them. If your wealth is ultimate, you will steal. If your success is ultimate, you will backstab and deceive. The other commandments flow from keeping the first. If God is truly ultimate, you will be freed to love other things rightly. Name one good thing you cling to for identity or safety. Not something bad, something genuinely good. Something that, if threatened, would make you anxious. Then, hold it open-handed in prayer without resolving anything. Do not pretend you are willing to lose it if you are not. Simply acknowledge, this is what I have made ultimate. Help me to hold this lightly. Help me to make you ultimate again. You do not have to promise willingness to lose the thing. That willingness will come through grace and time. But you can begin by naming it. The first commandment comes not as a threat, but as a promise. God is saying, I am the one who will prove faithful. I am the one worthy of ultimate allegiance. In giving us this commandment, God protects us not from joy, but for joy. Abraham learned this on the mountain. The choice is offered to us. Will we allow anything to rival God's place? Or will we learn that the freedom to let go is the secret to receiving all good things as gifts? That is the first commandment. That is the beginning of abundant living. Father, help us to trust you the way Abraham did, willing to surrender what we love most because we love you more. That's our episode. Remember, God calls you not only to live, but to thrive. Live life to the full. Today,